thing we could start with is, did anybody think of an additional question that you wished you had had me make a note about last night?
Well, the question I have is...
Yeah.
It seems that...
Don't worry about it.
Scripture, biblical...
Ah, yes.
Scripture, what part is it? Is play?
Oh, yeah. Sure, no, there are whole, you know, there are books on this and arguments about this. Walter Brueggemann's done a whole thing about it. Sure, no, it's good, no one else asked. Yeah, yes. It's, you know, it's on a page with the one, that last one has Petraeus and also the Iraq Study Group, it has both. And I hope all these pages of papers disappear because I'm not allowed to go home until they do. Anybody else think of a question overnight that you wished you had asked yesterday? We're still putting together a list of questions, and I think what we'll do on at least on Friday is to leave some time at the end in case there are some. I'll try to work in some of the questions to what I'm saying, but don't worry if it is. Let's see. Go ahead. Sure. Oh, well, thanks. Not all the time. My wife isn't here.
Another question I have is,
yes?
Do the these little, what do they call them, the little settlements?
Settlements, yes.
Do they keep, you know, establishing new ones?
Yes.
Does that just inflame the whole situation?
You bet. So you've answered your own question.
It does.
Yes. I mean, the little more complicated answer is that some of the settlements that have been established have been established very close to what probably would be the border between a Palestinian state and Israel. And there's already been negotiations and talks about incorporating those settlements into Israel, which would obviously give the Palestinians less land in their state. But then Israel giving the Palestinian state other pieces of land somewhere attached to the West Bank or Gaza as an exchange.
Oh.
And to just show how these negotiations go, in the beginning, the Israelis were saying, no way. Then in the negotiations, they said, well, yes, we'll give you one dunam of land for every three dunams we take. And about the same thing, you know, give it up, will you? And so now most people who are talking about an exchange are talking about a one-for-one exchange. If Israel incorporates a square mile of territory next to its border that brings in a number of Jewish settlements or settlers, that Palestine would get a dunam, a square mile of land either attached to the West Bank or Gaza. And that, you know, Lisa, these things are all what compromises, right? I mean, you know, they're not made in heaven.
Right.
And that sort of relates to the scripture question.
So these settlements look like chicken pox. You know what I mean?
Oh, on the map.
Yeah,
on the map. Oh, you looked at this map. Yeah. No, I mean, if you look at a picture now of the West Bank, well, first of all, the Israelis are out of Gaza, but as you know, they're still controlling Gaza. So in a way, being out is not the full story because they control all the borders of Gaza, and they don't allow, and they control everything going in and out. So in a way, though, they say, well, we got out of Gaza. It's part of the story, but not the whole. If you look at the West Bank, what you see is pockets of Palestinian Authority control, but other pockets all intertwined of Israeli control. That is a reflection of the Oslo Agreement, which at a certain stage agreed that Israel would have certain areas in the West Bank where it would keep control temporarily, Palestinian Authority would have certain areas, and they would share authority in some other areas. And I'll tell you a funny story about that, but it's a nice story. When they said share it, these are the political leaders of the two sides, they say, okay, so area, I think it was C or B, whatever, will be shared. And so then they turned it over to military people to negotiate, how do you share, you know? And the military people, and I met the Palestinian who was the chief negotiator, and he said, you know, we were locked in a hotel, and for each side said, we'll take care of it, we'll take care of security in the C areas, in the shared area. And of course, the other side wouldn't go with that. What they wound up agreeing to is that they would have joint security patrols of Israeli and Palestinian soldiers sharing a jeep with a flag that wouldn't be either Palestinian or Israeli, but would be orange for Netherlands soccer team. And when they first did it, and the Palestinian general said, he said, you know, we did this the first few days. He said, my boys and their boys weren't pointing their guns out of the Jeep. They were pointing it in the Jeep at the other guys. You know? Well, they've been used to doing that for a long time. And he said, so we had to do training for them. And he said, within several weeks, they began stopping for coffee. You know, so it was a story of how something that's sort of rough and crude, an agreement like that, can begin to work as people say, you know, look, our purpose in being here is not to kill each other anymore. It's somehow to provide this security. But we're getting off the track. We're gonna solve U.S. policy tonight. There you go.
About time somebody did.
About time. Thanks. Anybody who didn't sign up last night and would like occasionally receive emails from this interreligious initiative, before you leave, do sign your name and email. So U.S. policy is the topic tonight. Tomorrow we're going to look at the question, which obviously is pretty basic, is peace possible? And then on Friday, we're going to look at the question of interfaith cooperation or not cooperation. As you may know, on this issue, you can't take for granted that we're going to work together nicely, Jews, Christians, American Jews, Christians, and Muslims. You know, I mean, if you want to work together nicely, maybe we should work on recycling or something like that. But the Arab-Israeli conflict, you have people in our different communities who are strongly and very deeply attached to one side or the other, not the same side. And so inevitably, if you try to work together, sometimes it doesn't work at all. And in fact, in many cases, interfaith groups around the country that have been long established, working very smoothly, have conscientiously, and I'll use that word carefully, conscientiously decided not to deal with this issue. Because they're afraid if they do, they'll bust apart. They'll ruin the Thanksgiving service.
Just in our country or in...
No, this is here. This is here. Oh. So, for instance, in Washington, D.C., there's a huge interfaith coalition that puts on all kinds of programs. They have conscientiously and consistently said, we're not going to deal with this issue. Because they're afraid that they'll get into fights. Now, my work has been all in that area, interfaith. We'll talk about that on Friday. So, tonight, U.S. policy. This is, you know, oversimplified and in some ways, I'm sure, even wrong. But typically, there are two very common critiques of U.S. policy in the Middle East. And when I say in the Middle East, I mean in relation to this conflict. I'm not talking Iraq, I'm not talking Afghanistan or Iran. I'm talking the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Typically, there are two common critiques of U.S. policy. The first is what I would call a sort of, well, different words for it, academic, diplomatic, the kind of critique that if you gathered some foreign service people retired, they might together come up with, and even some who are active foreign service, where what they look at is, basically, they would say something like, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with U.S. policy, but the way it's implemented has problems in it. Things like, and by the way, I agree with much of this kind of critique. It's sometimes very active, and then sometimes seems to go away. In other words, the U.S. gets very actively involved in a period of time in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Think of Clinton, for example. And then a new president comes in, or events on the ground are so discouraging that the U.S. pulls back and says, well, we're not going to do anything for a while. So there's that sort of issue or problem. Sometimes it's sort of stop and go kind of engagement. A second problem is that the implementation of our policy is not carefully enough prepared. One of the critiques of the summit that Clinton hosted in July of 2000 at Camp David was that on certain very emotional issues, including Jerusalem, for example, there wasn't enough preparation before the summit. Now, obviously, a summit is a special case in diplomacy because a summit usually is something that you intend to make work, right? In other words, you don't have a summit when everything is loose and goosey and nobody knows what the hell to expect. You have a summit when things are sort of ready to be agreed upon, as say, but they're never quite ready, of course. But you do a lot of careful preparation, not only with the two sides, the two parties, but with other parties that might have some influence. For example, in the case of the summit on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, there was a critique that the U.S. did very little with the other Arab countries to prepare them to be supportive of the kind of compromise that might have to be made, which would give Arafat some support. if it was going to happen, for instance, on Jerusalem, some compromise in Jerusalem. All right, so that's a second kind of critique, and I'm not going to go into all the substance on each of these. Another critique in this kind, or another point in this kind of critique, is the president either is too could be too involved and sort of spend his marbles, if you know what I mean. In other words, when the president gets involved, you expect more to happen, as compared to, say, the Secretary of State, or an ambassador, or a special envoy like George Mitchell. So the president could be too involved, could be a part of, could be an element of the Greek, or he's not involved enough. Why didn't the president get involved at that point and do more? Another piece of that is the whole idea of a special envoy. Our interreligious coalition, from the time it started in 2003, called for the appointment of a special envoy. Why? Because it seems obvious. It seemed obvious to us that no president could give the amount, nor a Secretary of State could give the amount of consistent energy and time to this issue that it needed, because of all the issues that those persons have to deal with. And therefore, a special envoy who can be on the ground regularly, can keep in touch, can regularly report to the Secretary of State and President, very important role. Well, the whole question of a special envoy is an issue. And sometimes we've had one, and sometimes we have not. We do right now. Another part of this kind of critique is you were too open in your diplomacy, said too much, or you said too little. Right now, for instance, there are proximity talks going on. These are talks where the parties, Israel and the Palestinians, are not meeting directly with each other, but only each party meeting with George Mitchell. And the reason for the word proximity is they might happen to be in the same hotel. But they're not meeting with each other. They're not having dinner with each other. They're not regularly in touch with each other at all. But George Mitchell's going back and forth. All right, so that's a... And we don't know what's going on. I mean... There's no reports every day that what's going on in proximity talks. Things are going on, but we don't know. You know, things are going on. Things could be a failure. Things could be a success. Things could be progress. So this is an issue of how open should the diplomacy be, or how closed should it be, and when is it appropriate to be one or the other? Also, another piece of this kind of a critique is that the United States is not adequately using its carrots and sticks with the two parties, with the different parties. Obviously, we, as a big power, or any country, but as a big country, a big powerful country, we have carrots and sticks we could use. And I don't mean, sticks don't mean guns, carrot doesn't mean money. There are a whole lot of things that could be qualified as carrots and sticks. And so a possible critique of this kind of how the thing is policy being implemented is, we failed to use sufficient carrots and sticks. We should have used more then. Or we wasted carrots and sticks at a certain point on a certain issue, and we shouldn't have. We should have held back and used it on a more opportune time on a more important issue. I'll stop there. You get an idea. This is a kind of critique of policy, and as you can hear from what I'm saying, it's a critique which assumes that the basic policy is a good policy, and the questions are about how to implement it to be effective. All right, so that's one critique. Another common critique is a critique which says, and obviously this comes, you'll hear from more from the Palestinian side, the problem with our policy is it's too favorable to Israel and not favorable enough to the Palestinians, and the policy should be shifted to be fair, to be balanced, to be, I mean, that those kind of words. That's another kind of critique. And sometimes with that goes a critique of the politics in our own country, in the sense that people say that the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, the formal Israeli lobby, which is called the American Israel Council for Public on Public Affairs, American Israel Council Public Affairs, AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs, Public, I don't know what the hell it is, but Israeli lobby, AIPAC. American Israeli Public Affairs Council. Those letters work. There, I got it. I have trouble with letters. Never mind words. So some people would say that AIPAC has too much influence on our policy. And obviously AIPAC has considerable influence, particularly on members of Congress, to some extent on the administration, but somewhat less so. I mean, party course administrations are less vulnerable, at least for 4 years, than members of Congress are. But so this critique has to do, as I say, it comes mainly from the side of Palestinian supporters, but also from people who want to see peace and who think that it would even be helpful to Israel if our policy wasn't so friendly or so supportive of it, what Israel does, and was more supportive of what Palestinians need done. So that's a second critique. Now, I'm going to offer a third view, which is a critique of our policy more basically, and it doesn't contradict either one of these critiques. Both of these critiques might have some relevance in the kind of picture I'm presenting, but I'm going to suggest this as a sort of thesis for this critique, that there are problematic tendencies in U.S. foreign policy worldwide that also happen in the Middle East, and that these tendencies contribute to our inability to help the parties reach a peace agreement. But that there are problematic tendencies in our policies worldwide. And why do I have a bias in that direction? Partly because I work from 1965 to 1975 entirely on the Vietnam War. I mean, that's the issue I worked on. And I studied it, and I wrote about it, and I protested about it, and I met Congress about it, and did all kinds of things in a sort of peace movement way. And so I obviously, when I come to a new issue, I bring some ideas about U.S. foreign policy that I developed in the course of that. I also had some experience in Latin America, in particular a very moving experience in El Salvador. I've also looked at the history of our country's policy with Iran. And then we went to the Middle East, 82 to 85, and I can tell you, we really went quite, well, I'll put it bluntly, ignorant. Now you say, what the hell are the Quakers up to? They sent ignoramuses to the Middle East. I mean, and the advantage was that our assignment was to listen. Well, it's much easier to listen if you know you don't know nothing. It is much easier. In other words, you're starting out pretty much from scratch. Now, they put us through an orientation where we read things and met people in the U.S. before we went over. But even when we got there, we were still really neophytes, and so we had to listen to people. And in the course of our listening to people, and when I say people, I mean people we lived in Jordan, people in Israel, different people, officials, non-officials, people among the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, people in Egypt, people in Syria, and at least two or three times people in Lebanon. What we discovered, and this was very interesting, that while as things develop, clearly each of the parties, and just for the moment I'll say Israelis and Palestinians as the two parties, each of the parties could have done more, could have done different things that would have helped move the situation to peace. We also came to feel pretty clearly that some of the things the U.S. did and didn't do contributed to a lack of movement toward peace. And at a couple of times, or more than a couple of times, three or four times, when there seemed to be developments that offered some prospect of moving to negotiations and then maybe moving to a peace agreement, what the U.S. did or didn't do was not helpful. An interesting further thing that we discovered, and this may surprise you, is that in several of these situations, a number of Israelis and Palestinians we met with agreed with each other about what the United States was doing that wasn't helping. And that was a bit surprising because our understanding of U.S. policy was that it was for Israel. So when you had Israelis, and by the way, I'm not talking about just, all of you know the name Abba Ibn? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Famous foreign minister of Israel. Abba Ibn, we sat in the living room with him, and he critiqued U.S. policy at a certain point regarding what was going on with the U.S. and Lebanon and Israel. He was adamant and eloquent. And when we said, well, you know, Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig think that what we're doing is a good thing, he said, they're stupid. They're arrogant. He said, and this related to the fact that the U.S. had negotiated a peace agreement between Lebanon and Israel without ever negotiating with Syria, and yet the agreement said that Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon was contingent on Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon. But they never negotiated with Syria. And Abba Ibn said, what? These are stupid men. And, you know, Abba even can get away with that kind of thing. Quakers would never use that kind of thing. But so here was an example where what we were hearing from Syrians was being confirmed in a loud way by a very prominent Israeli in terms of what was the problem with U.S. policy. Now, if those things are true, those impressions, and they're obviously impressions we develop, what are the problems I'm talking about in U.S. policy that are policies around the world, or have been, that contribute to our failing to help bring peace in the Middle East? The first, I would say, is the way that for 40 years, from the late 40s till the late 80s, the Cold War was the framework for U.S. foreign policy. That is, the war with the Soviet Union, the war between anti-communism and communism. And that framework led U.S. policymakers to define countries, political movements, certain leaders, according to which side were they on. Were they pro-anti-communist and therefore, quote, good, or pro-communist and therefore bad? And oftentimes, people who were not necessarily, who wouldn't necessarily categorize themselves in those terms, were in any case categorized. And so you had, I think, this meant for a distorted, a simplistic, and somewhat distorted view of situations. Now, as you may know, in the Middle East, during these years, the Soviet Union supported Syria. The Soviet Union supported the PLO. We supported Israel. Israel was antagonistic not just to the PLO and Syria, but also to the Soviet Union. So here it is. The Cold War framework defines it. And when it defines it that way, as you can imagine, it presents certain difficulties in terms of trying to mediate a peace agreement between the parties. Partly because, in some circumstances, and I'll give you an example of this, it was more important to the U.S. in a given circumstance to gain advantage over the Soviet Union than it was to have a peace agreement. Because that was the defining controlling thing, and as you may know, it was also a controlling framework for much of domestic policy. That is, priorities in this country. Because the Cold War was the crunching thing. Now, since the Soviet Union went away, unfortunately, and this has to do, obviously, with the attack on September 11, 2001, we have, at least during the Bush administration, adopted a new framework which functions in a similar way. And it is the War on terrorism, exactly. And so once a party or a group or a movement is defined as in that terrorist camp or a terrorist organization, that's all you need to know, basically. That's all you need to know. We are against them, they're against us. And any kind of subtlety, distinctions, nuance, complexity in that movement or that group is not that as important as the fact that they're defined as terrorists. And, you know, one of the simple things that has led to is we have no contact with Hamas. And we can come back to that as an issue, because it's not a simple issue. And obviously after September 11th, it wasn't like Bush and Cheney pulled this out of the air. I mean, there was a lot of fear, reasonably so, in our country after 9/11. I think that the combination of fear, Americans' fear, our fears, and I'm sort of embarrassed to say, but I think you know this, a rather shameful level of ignorance about world affairs and peoples and countries. Partly because we're large. You know, when you're large, you think you're the world. China may have some of the same problems, you know. But in any case, we do. And if you look at surveys, I saw a survey by a combination of Gallup and one other group that said that high school graduates could not identify on a map. This was just like 2006, could not identify not only where Iran was on a map, but where Israel was on a map. Couldn't find it on a map, world map. So a combination of our ignorance about world things, but then also our fears generated by 9/11, I think then played on by political leaders for purposes that they would consider, I assume they would consider good purposes. The war on terrorism became the sort of lockdown framework for U.S. policy and plays a similar role in simplifying, making simplistic, and distorting our views of situations and groups and peoples and what are the possibilities in those situations. Let me be clear, I'm not saying we should be supporting terrorists or that there was no reason to be opposed to communism. I'm not saying that. I'm saying something much more modest, which is to the extent that you allow that to define your policy, framework your policy, it becomes too simplistic and needs to be nuanced, needs to be complicated. And if you remember back during the Cold War, when people tried to nuance things, oftentimes they were, you know, they were condemned. I mean, you're being pro-communist. All right, so that's number one. And let me just say, I think that was a huge problem in terms of our policy in Vietnam. Huge problem. I think it was also a problem in Iran, where I don't know if you remember this, but the Iranians do. Oftentimes the people who do these things don't remember. The people that have them done to them remember them forever. There was an elected government in Iran in the early 50s. Head of it was named Mossadegh, Mohammad Mossadegh. And our CIA, to this day, I think probably brags on the coup that they engineered that overthrew him. And the reason that he was overthrown was that both British oil interests and American oil interests were interested in oil in Iran, and Mossadegh seemed open to also Soviet interests in oil in Iran. And so there it was. The framework was clear. What you had to do was clear. You had to get rid of it. And we did. Mossadegh gone. And, you know, Iranians today still talk about that. So there is Vietnam and Iran, but and I'll give examples in a minute about the situation in the Arab-Israeli. Second, problematic in our policies, a tendency to overestimate what military power can do. Yes. When you have so much of it relative to everybody else, it's a natural tendency. I mean, these things are not, again, they're not tendencies generated by some monsters. They come quite easily and naturally. When we have so much military power, and we saw military power at work, say, in World War II, you sort of assume and think that military power can accomplish more than military power may be able to accomplish. And I think that was a problem, to say the least, in Vietnam. I mean, we talked about this a little bit last night, you know.
I have another comment for you on that one.
Okay. Obviously, this is my view that the situation in Vietnam was complicated by a sense that somehow the military power we had up against the Vietnamese, okay, with some Russian help and so forth, not to be minimized, but that the Vietnamese Liberation Front was going to, they were going to beat us? Come on, you know? Now, we might well have learned from the French, who were beaten. But in any case, the point here is that this having so much military power, we tend to overestimate what it can do. I would add, as a comment in the Middle East conflict, that Israel is the greatest military power in the region. And they have the same tendency. And sometimes their tendency to overestimate what their military power is reinforced by our tendency to think that their military power, which we've helped build up, can do more than it can do. Third, and it's a corollary with this one. The corollary to overestimating what military power can do is underestimating what popular movements for justice and peace can accomplish. And I must say, one of the things that I think was true in Vietnam is that it was difficult to understand how this movement, the Viet Minh, headed by Ho Chi Minh, could possibly be strong enough to keep us at bay or even in some way finally to defeat us, barring our doing more, more military power. I think it was true in Iran. I don't think our administration, U.S. administration, was in tune at all with the growing opposition to the Shah of Iran, who was an ally of ours, and by the way, also an ally of Israel. And this movement, which involves students of all things, students, you know? I mean, who are they? What do they have compared to the Shah and his great military power and wealth and economic power? But students and religious clergy overthrew the Shah. So that, I want to come back to the Middle East. The fourth, also related to being a big power. I mean, you know, some days I wish we were Canada. I mean, in a sort of silly way, because we're not, and it's sort of useless, but I mean, when Carol and I go from Seattle to Canada, when we go to BC, you sort of breathe a little freer. Not because Canada's freer, but you don't have the burden of living in the middle of the elephant, you know? That has so much power and can do so much good, but also can do so much bad. And you sort of feel, we're in Vancouver. This last thing is the tendency of the United States to go it alone in foreign policy, rather than to work with or listen to our friends, our allies, or to work with the United Nations. Just think of the difference between the two wars in Iraq. The first Gulf War, where the United States, with UN involvement, mustered a huge coalition of countries to expel Saddam Hussein's army from Kuwait. They had invaded Kuwait and taken over Kuwait. Think of the difference between that war and that coalition and the sort of dynamics of it worldwide and the dynamics of the second war, where we did get Tony Blair on the board, but that was about it plus a few Latin American countries. And we went to war in Iraq. We invaded Iraq. And it was a worldwide controversy. It was a very big controversy here, but it was also a worldwide controversy with many countries that really were friendly to the U.S., weren't in favor of Saddam Hussein, who were critical of the U.S. going. So think of the difference of those two wars, and one of the differences, clearly, I think there are two differences. One is, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, it was sort of blatantly against international law and common agreements and so forth. When we went into Iraq, it wasn't exactly clear what the legal international basis was, but the other difference was that in the First World War, we assembled a broad coalition and went with the UN, as we, by the way, sort of did in Korea. And in the second one, we basically went by ourselves with the British, and that was it. And you know, it was very controversial. But now, I want to look, I want to say one more thing about these tendencies. One of the things about the tendencies, I've hinted at it when I said that Carol and I were quite surprised in a way, but also convinced, because it happened several times, when there'd be significant Israelis and Palestinians, and sometimes other Arabs, Jordanians or Syrians, who would seem to agree on what was wrong about our policies. That was interesting. And a version of that, which I want to just state here, is it suggests that even though we say we're a big supporter of Israel, that at least on some occasions, some Israelis believe that we're dangerous, our policies endanger Israel. The simplest way to say that is the way many Israelis would say it. Unless Israel reaches a peace agreement with the Palestinian people and with the other Arab states that are still to be made peace with Syria and Lebanon, Israel is either finished or in a continuous state of conflict and violence. And I say finished, Ehud Olmert, who's not viewed as a dove in Israel, the Likud guy, followed Sharon, Ehud Olmert gave an interview in Haaretz in which he said if the two-state solution is finished, Israel is finished. Because what then you face is, if you remember the map up here, you face Palestinians, not only 20% of the current Israeli citizens are Palestinians, Israelis, but you have all the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, and either you'll have a democracy in that whole area, eventually you'll have apartheid first. Apartheids don't last, we know that. There'll be a lot of bloodshed to make it end, but basically it will end at some point. And then you have one state. You either have one state with all those people, and that means a majority are not Jews, so you don't have a Jewish state anymore, or Israel maintains by military means this state where only Israel has controlling political power over the majority of the people living there, who will be Palestinians, and then you don't have a democratic state. So it's the end of Israel. And what I'm saying here is it may sound ironic to you, but I'm voicing now what I've heard from some Israelis, not all Israelis, of course, but some Israelis say that U.S. policies that don't help us make peace are endangering the survival of Israel. And I want to quote a Lebanese. At a certain point, this was after the Israelis had invaded Lebanon in 82, the U.S. helped to bring a government to power. The first attempt, there was an assassination Bashir Gemayel, then his brother came in and was in power, and the U.S. worked closely, was very supportive of him, and there were big troubles. There was big turmoil in the country, many Lebanese opposed to the government, but the U.S. was supporting the government. And this Lebanese said to us, said, you know, it may be dangerous to have the United States as your friend, but if you have the United States as your only ally, it's suicidal. And this was fascinating, because this Lebanese was not an extremist. But now I want to apply that to Israel. that it could be dangerous for Israel to have us as its main friend, but if we're its only ally, maybe if our policies aren't helping it to get to peace, it might be suicidal for Israel. Now let me just give some examples of how this has worked. When in 1982, and I'm not going to go into all the circumstances, but there were some cross-border attacks from PLO forces inside Lebanon into Israel, and it's been going on. There had been a tentative ceasefire, was sort of holding, but it was a messy situation. Israel decided to invade Lebanon. When they did, all observers in Washington believed that the U.S., Alexander Haig, then Secretary of State, gave a green light to the Israeli army going into Lebanon. In this is 82, so June of 82. The reason the Israelis went in was to knock out the PLO. The PLO had its military in Lebanon, was occasionally firing rockets across the border into Israel. So the theory was, we're going to go in and knock out the PLO. And in the same movement, in the same invasion, shift Lebanon out of the orbit of Syria and the Soviet Union, because Syria has support there, and toward the west. And this was something the U.S. also wanted to do. And the U.S., some U.S. policymakers, I think including Alexander Haig, believed that the Israeli military was powerful enough to do this, to not just knock out the PLO, which they did, the PLO military, but also to shift Lebanon away. The result was the rapid growth of Hezbollah. The rapid growth of Hezbollah became a power because of the war in Lebanon. I mean, it became a power in Lebanon. In 2006, Hezbollah launched some attacks over the northern border of Israel, into Israel, and Israel went into Lebanon again, 2006. The theory was again, I don't know if you remember this period, but all the other European countries were calling for an immediate ceasefire. The UN was calling for an immediate ceasefire, and Secretary Condoleezza Rice was saying, no, we need to wait a while. We need to wait a little bit. It's too premature. The reason she was saying premature was because she believed the Israeli army going in could help readjust Lebanon to be more oriented toward Israel and toward the West, because the occupation would do that. You know what happened? Hezbollah got stronger and is now the most potent political force in Lebanon. So here's a situation where military power, the biggest in the region, I mean Israel has in fact proven that by defeating all the Arab armies a couple of times. It's the fourth or something like that most potent military in the world compared to the army Arab militaries, which are, you know, relatively not, I mean, they're not anywhere near Israel's military capacity, either in terms of its technology, its air force, its weaponry, its training, to some extent its morale, because, you know, many of the Arab countries are authoritarian, dictatorial, and so you don't necessarily have the same morale as in this Jewish-Israeli army, which sees itself as defending the Jewish state. So a number of factors that would go into judging how strong the military is. So those are two examples, and they're examples of where both overestimating military power and also the tendency to put our policy in a certain framework where we're seeing actions that are taking place as moving Lebanon out of the Syrian orbit toward the U.S. orbit, putting that framework on it, rather than, for example, another possibility would be, how do we achieve real peace between Syria, Lebanon, and Israel? All right, another example. As a result of that war in 82, President Reagan launched an initiative for peace, and was an initiative to try to get Jordan and the Palestinians to agree on a joint negotiating team to negotiate with Israel. Eventually, actually, that happened several years later. And as it went along, one of the things that happened, there was a change in the Israeli government, and Shimon Peres, who's a Labor Party, more inclined toward peace, came to be the Prime Minister of Israel in 84. One of the issues for King Hussein in Jordan and for the PLO was they wanted an international conference that would include the Soviet Union, include the major powers of the Security Council, to launch the negotiations. Why did they want that? For two reasons. One is, King Hussein and Yasser Arafat, the PLO, they were concerned that within their own people, their own ranks, there was critiques about whether they were going to give the store away, whether they were going to compromise so weakly with Israel. So they wanted an international conference as a kind of ballast in that. And King Hussein in particular was concerned that Syria didn't like the idea that King Hussein and Arafat were doing this together, because Syria thinks it's the main protector of the Palestinians. And so King Hussein wanted it, and the word that was used in all the media is he wanted the conference as a kind of international cover for going into negotiations with Israel. You remember I said a couple days ago that when Egypt went into negotiations with Israel, the Arab states all rejected it. But Egypt said, let them go to hell, you know? In other words, Egypt could say, they'll come around to our view, we don't have to go to their view. Jordan's a different story. It's a small country, 4 million people, located between Israel, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and 65% of its population are Palestinian. So the king walks a careful road. And so he, in particular, wanted an international conference to start it. International conferences at that time were very, Israelis were very wary about, partly because the General Assembly in the UN had passed a number of resolutions, including Zionism's racism, other resolutions that Israel considered the UN to be instinctively anti-Israel. So the idea of an international conference was quite controversial in Israel. But Shimon Peres, the prime minister, saw this opportunity to get negotiations going, and when he addressed the UN, he addressed the General Assembly in the fall of 85, he announced that Israel was prepared to accept an international conference started with the UN Security Council to begin the negotiations. This was a surprise for many. He then went to Washington, and President Reagan told him, no way will the U.S. support an international conference. Why? From Peres' point of view, it was more important to get negotiations with the Palestinians and Jordan going than it was to keep the Russians out. From Reagan's point of view, exactly the opposite. It was more important to keep the Russians out than it was to get the negotiations going. Basic U.S. policy. I mean, there's the difference. And that was the end of the Reagan initiative. That was the end of it. Let me see one or two more examples. I'll just go to the sort of most recent. Let me back up a minute, because this point about overestimating military power, that's pretty clear. The Cold War framework, pretty clear. The business about underestimating the aspirations of popular movements. Well, you know, again, a big power. What's a popular movement to a big power? You know? I mean, come on. These are kids, these are individuals, this is nothing, you know? So the Palestinian PLO movement was never taken enough account of, at least in Washington policymakers making circles. We would not talk with the PLO. If you remember, there were years after the PLO was founded in 64, we would not talk with them. Interestingly, when you got closer to the ground in U.S. Foreign Service circles, meaning ambassadors on the ground in the Middle East, you found much more realism. That is to say, when Carol and I, who met regularly with the PLO, would come to a U.S. embassy in Cairo or Syria, or even in Israel, they'd be very interested in talking with us about what we were learning from the PLO and what was going on. And off the record, a number of the ambassadors said to us, we're going to have to talk to the PLO, Israel's going to have to, it's very clear. Now, they may have been writing memos back to Washington saying that, but it never became U.S. policy until 1988. So for 24 years after the PLO was established, the U.S. would not talk with the PLO. And that, to me, is an example of, and they had illusions that somehow Jordan could talk for the Palestinians, or maybe it could be some kind of a clever joint delegation or something, you know? Or maybe there are other Palestinians we could talk to beside those that loyal to the PLO. It was just unrealistic. So we weren't taking seriously the Palestinian movement that may not be impressive compared to a global power like the United States, but it was the Palestinian movement. It was what represented Palestinians. So if you tried to go to Palestinians and say, well, aren't there some Palestinians other than PLO could go? The answer you got, except from a few who sometimes were literally collaborators, I mean, people who were paid by Israel, the answer you got was PLO is it. That's it. That's the address if you want to talk to the Palestinians. On the Israeli side, there wasn't a PLO. Obviously, you had an Israeli government or different Israeli governments, but you also had a very active Israeli peace movement named Shlomo Achshav, Peace Now, started at the same time I said yesterday that Sadat came to Jerusalem. And it was a potent force. I mean, it, as I said, it was started by reserve army officers, Israeli reserve army officers. There was another group started, I'm not even sure of the dates, but probably in the 80s, called the Council of Peace and Israeli Council of Peace and Security. It was made up of only majors, retired majors, generals above. In other words, that high level of Israeli retired army people. And it took the position, negotiated with the PLO, supportive of a Palestinian state, shared Jerusalem as capital of both countries, both Palestine and Israel. And this was in the mid-80s. I met a number of times with the mayor of Tel Aviv, who was a very popular guy named Shlomo Ahad. I mean, I don't know my New York mayors well enough, but to compare her with some city mayor who's like, just, you know, oh, he's great. Everybody likes him, even when they don't vote for him. I mean, he's just our guy, you know. He was very popular, did a lot of things to develop Tel Aviv into a marvelous, basically European-type city. And Shlomo Ahad, I took a group to meet with him in late 80s, probably. We met in his office, in the mayor's office in Tel Aviv, and he said to us very clearly, he says, look, the Palestinians have just as much of a right to self-determination as we Jews do here in this land. That was the mayor of Tel Aviv, and he said this publicly all the time. When he'd come to New York, he would, you know, rile some of the American Jewish leaders. You know, he'd say, we got to negotiate with the PLO. No way, you stupid, of course we got it. And so he'd come to New York and say this thing, Mayor Koch would get all upset because they thought they were for Israel. You know, and here's the mayor from Tel Aviv telling them they're full of something. And he was that kind of guy. He was rather brusque. He had a sense of humor. He didn't hold back his views, and his views were along this line. Well, this is an example of Israeli Jewish Zionist, because he was a Zionist, he was supportive of a Jewish state, who was critical of American policy in similar ways to the way the Palestinians were. One of the biggest beefs the Palestinians had was, why won't the U.S. support the principle of the right of self-determination for Palestinians? In fact, and this leads to sort of the last point, or an example from that, from the 1970s on, just about every European country, no matter what the government, whether it was a conservative government or a more progressive government, was saying to the U.S., the two principles that have to guide negotiations for peace in the Middle East, one is security for Israel, the other is self-determination for the Palestinian people, which means a Palestinian state. And they were saying this consistently to the U.S., and the U.S. would never say it. And I think it in one part of it, it obviously wasn't taking our allies very seriously, but on another part of it, it reflected a failure to take seriously enough the Israeli movement, the Israeli popular aspiration, to move in this direction toward negotiations with the PLO and toward a Palestinian state. So I sort of say again this question, that it seems to me that if there's some elements, and I know that, I mean, what I'm saying can argue a number of ways and so forth, but if there's some elements of what I'm saying about a critique of U.S. policy that I learned to some extent, first in relation to Vietnam, and then some Latin American countries, but then in the Middle East, if there's some truth in that, one of the ironies is that it's a policy, it's a set of problematic tendencies in our policy that can just as easily sometimes endanger our friends as it endangers, as much or more than it endangers, quote, our enemies. And in this case, endangers Israel. And to the extent that that's true, of course, one of the things it means is, well, two things it means. One is, if I'm right about this, we can't, I hope, we're not prepared to blame you. If we believe U.S. policies in Vietnam were wrong, we can't blame that on the Israeli lobby. Can't blame that on the Jews. Or our policies in Latin America, if we believe they were short-sighted, whether in El Salvador or Nicaragua, or when we supported dictatorships throughout Central America and South America for years. Why? Because of anti-communism. Stroessner in Paraguay, I mean, one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world. He made Batista in Cuba and Trujillo in the Dominican Republic look like liberals. But we supported him. Why? Because he fit the anti-communist thing. He was anti-communist. We were anti-communist. Except we supported him. We supported him. As we did Batista in Cuba for years, you know, and Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, and Papa Doc in Haiti, where my parents lived for a year. If this is true, then number one thing is that it means that we may be endangering. Let's take South Vietnam. You know, South Vietnam as a separate place is gone. Iran that we knew was gone. And these were our friends. These were the countries and the leaders that we were protecting. But they're gone. And might we, in fact, then be endangering Israel? We can't blame these kinds of problems in our policy on Jews, I think. I mean, it'd be a far stretch for me, and more than a far stretch, it seems to me, then we are into anti-Semitism in some version, because the idea that Jews, you know, Jews are responsible for our wrong policies in Vietnam is, to me, just not only far-fetched. A second thing it means is that, and part of the reason it's so far-fetched is that many Jews, the majority of Jews, were opposed to those policies in Vietnam. In regard to Israel, in a certain sense, and this is putting it crudely, Jews get suckered in. Suckered in because they're scared, because they're worried about Israel, and because there are both forces in Israel and AIPAC here that say these policies in the United States are protecting Israel, protecting Israel, protecting Israel. Now, there are other Jews that pretty consistently for the last 30 years have been saying, whoa, thanks for this, we don't need it. Mm-hmm. What we need is peace with the Palestinians. What we need is peace with Syria. And now you have a whole Jewish peace lobby called J Street that you ought to definitely go on their website and see what they're saying. And that they have substantial support in the Jewish community. So another thing that's a result of this kind of view is we realize we're freed up to be talking with Jewish friends and other, you know, Jewish leaders in the community saying, look, what's your feeling about the current situation? Do you think Obama is against Israel, for example? This is one of the lines that conservatives are putting out, that Obama's anti-Israel or anti-Jewish. Of course, it's because he's a Muslim and he wasn't born here in the first place. it comes down to that. If you look at some of the stuff being put out by neocons that got us to the Iraq War, they're saying these kind of things about Obama. And there are forces in Israel that are saying it too. I mean, Netanyahu's sort of playing it both ways. But there are certainly, the foreign minister of Israel is very anti-Obama. But it means that we as Christians can work together with a segment of the Jewish community. And frankly, and we'll come to this the last day, I think if we do, the chances of our having political impact are great if we're working together. But let me stop there and just open it up. I mean, I must have caused some problems in my view. Remember those first two critiques. The one that's a critique, and in fact, the first critique would apply whatever the policy is. In other words, if the policy is more like I'd like to see it or more like it is, that first critique about when should the president be involved? How much to use sticks and carrots? When to use them? Those kind of things are all very relevant, very relevant. They are the sort of stuff of diplomacy. And the second critique about AIPAC having so much influence, it's true. I think AIPAC tends to play off these problematic tendencies and use them in a way for what they see as good for Israel. But some people disagree with that. So what? Yeah, go ahead.
What do you think the impact will be of the grandchildren of those who were both Americans and became Israelis and were in power or were in World War II, and now the grandchildren of those people, particularly in the United States, stepping into roles of politicians,
Are you, now, are you talking about Jews?
Yes, yes. What do you think about, I'm wondering what the impact will be on the tone of U.S. policy as those people become, particularly in the U.S., become more of the movers and shakers in the United States.
American Jews,
right,
whose parents may have been involved in World War II?
Well, they were involved in World War II. They were the as they call us, our generation in the United States, the greatest generation. Mm-hmm. That generation, now their grandchildren are now becoming more players in the United States policy and power, and I'm wondering what the impact is.
Well, I mean, I'm a little bit fuzzy on your question, so if my answer is a little bit fuzzy, we've met each other. One of the things that's true is that younger American Jews, two things about them in regard to this conflict. One is they tend to be less interested in Israel than their parents. Less interested. They have other things that are, you know, I mean, in some ways, it's sort of like, in one sense, it's like an immigrant community, but it's not. I mean, they probably, their family's been here for several generations. But younger American Jews, if you look at the polls that have been done by, say, American Jewish community, you find less identification with Israel. And to the extent that Israeli policies are very, are palpably hurtful to Palestinians, the percentage of interest in Israel goes down among younger American Jews. In other words, there's some relationship about conscience in that sequel. It's not just that they have other things that they're more interested in, but they're sort of, you know, come on. Like, there's not an automatic defense of Israel in the way that for their parents' generation or grandparents, there may have been, in part because it was closer to the Holocaust. And in part also because, remember this, because Jews remember it, and we Christians should, that for many, many years the Arabs said, get rid of Israel. That was real. That wasn't a figment of some Jew's imagination. I mean, it was their policy to get rid of Israel. And the PLO's policy for 40 years, get rid of Israel. So the fact that the grandparents and parents, not only closer to the Holocaust, but they were facing Arabs who totally rejected the existence of Israel, weren't willing to negotiate with it or anything. And that goes up through basically until Sadat, and for other Arab countries, until 2002, when there was this Arab initiative. There was an earlier version of it, which sort of, it said, it sounded like it was ready to make peace, but it wouldn't use the word Israel. You know, and obviously that makes Jews nervous. Huh? So that's what I can say about the younger generation. If you look at polls among American Jews by age group, you'll find that those who are active on this issue, that a higher percentage support the kind of J Street positions of advocacy for peace and supporting Obama, pushing Israel as well as the Palestinians, than those who support AIPAC, though AIPAC with $16 million budget, as compared with J Street of 4 or 5 million, they still can mobilize larger conventions and things like that. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah,
it's getting at it? Okay, yeah.
Has the Obama administration made any changes in the U.S.?
I think that's great. I mean, one of the early things, I don't know if anybody saw it on television, when Secretary of State Clinton and Obama went to the State Department after Clinton had been appointed, did any of you see it? It was extraordinary. I mean, here are these Foreign Service career people in the State Department, all sophisticated people at their jobs for a long time, and they went wild. I mean, in their enthusiasm for the appointment of Clinton and Obama coming to, you know, say, sort of say, give her to them. What was that about? They're all Clinton lovers or Obama? No, it wasn't about that. It was because both Obama and Clinton had said that diplomacy is going to play a much greater role in our foreign policy. And our State Department for many years has felt like second or sixth fiddle to the military. And I don't mean this is not anti-military, because if you're listening, military commanders, including McChrystal, God bless him, McChrystal and Petraeus are saying also that diplomacy has to play a much greater role in our effort. In other words, these are guys that are committed, trained, good at their job at the military, but they say, given the problems we're dealing with, diplomacy has to. But the State Department, did some of you see it on television? I happened to watch it, I guess maybe it was on the news. But you had State Department, Foreign Service people cheering. And it wasn't because because they were for Clinton. It may be for Clinton, they may be for Obama. But the point was that there was a signal from the Obama administration that diplomacy was going to play a much greater role in our policy. Even in Afghanistan, which is a whole other subject, we could not deal with. All right, so that's one thing. Second, in terms of Schiff, Obama said, he said in his campaign, and he said within 2 days of taking office, this is a high urgent priority for the United States. And you remember what he did? The first interview he gave with Arab television. Amazing, amazing. And then the plan to go and give a speech in Cairo. Extraordinary. He appoints George Mitchell within what? A week or two of taking office. George Mitchell, who has both a real value and also a symbolic value because he negotiated Northern Ireland successfully, and because, I don't know if you know this, he was appointed by George Bush as the chairman of a group to do an evaluation of why the Palestinians erupted in a second uprising in 2000, after the failure of the Camp David summit with Clinton. George Mitchell was the guy who did that, and the report is terrific. The problem was that the Bush administration didn't do it. I mean, what the report said should happen. The Bush administration didn't do it. So that's the second thing. He's made it a priority. He's sticking to it. I would just put a parenthesis there. I think Obama made a big mistake, not on that trip to Cairo, because I think it should have been separate, but that soon after that, he should have gone to Israel. Should have gone to Israel. And he should have asked to address the Knesset. And, of course, they would invite him to address the Knesset. Because I think he's got a message, and America has a message for Israeli Jews that is positive and reassuring, including helping Israel make peace with its neighbors. And I think Obama can be persuasive. I wish he were a little more emotional sometimes. I mean, I heard Clinton at Byrd's funeral, and Clinton was a master at that, you know? I mean, just incredible. He just made you feel like he felt it. And Obama makes you feel like he knows it. But not necessarily that he feels it, and that's too bad. But still in all, I wish he had gone to Israel in, say, 2 months after or something like that. That's complicated because Netanyahu was just coming into office. He's calling for a settlement freeze. Obama is, and Netanyahu's saying no way. So it's a little bit, it's messy, but I think he needs, and there's talk now about possible, he gave an interview to Israeli television just recently, Obama did. And that was good. But I think it's got to be, you know, face-to-face, hands-on. Because as you can imagine, whereas here, as Americans, we might say, well, that was neat that he addressed the Muslim world. In Israel, a little shakier, you know? A little shakier. And you know, it's not Nixon or Smith. It's Obama. Barack Hussein Obama. You know, who was born where? Oh, well, where did he live? In Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world? So, I mean, fair enough. Jews are a little nervous, you know? And one of the things I would just say to you, if you're talking with Jews, is try starting by asking a question, and not like, why don't you do more for the Palestinians? A question that elicits some of their feelings about what's going on, some of their hopes, some of their nervousness. Realizing that you're talking to people or a person who's had a different grandmother's experience than yours. Anyway. Yep. How are we doing? Are we doing okay?
No, I think we're going to
church.
Okay, we got to go to church. Boy, I'm a pastor's husband. I wouldn't want to say no to that. Yeah, 7 o'clock it is tonight, so I think we should break now, realizing that we have 2 more days to get everything clear.